You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT. Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev and Katie this week. How are you, Anne?
I'm well, Kevin. As you might have guessed, our dear listener might have guessed, I'm the one pressing the buttons today.
Well, it's all good. Like, we all multitask around here. That's excellent. Katie, how are you?
I'm beside myself with happiness, sharing the studio with both of you at once. It's wonderful.
Oh, we love to have you here.
If you're beside yourself with happiness, I must be happiness because I'm beside...
You are leaving the world in a better place, Kev. I saw you untangling cables earlier.
Yeah, that's my OCD thing from tangled cables.
It's a useful thing, a bit of OCD.
Yeah. Hey, we're approaching Radiothon next month, but that's in June. I'm just giving listeners a heads up because
the merry month of June.
Yeah, because this station is incredibly poor. When you have a look at the spreadsheet, you wonder how the place actually survives. It's amazing.
Smell of an oily rag.
Yeah. And we're the economics show and the macroeconomics show, so all the rich people listen to our show. So it's time they prepared themselves to dig deep. Just going to give that one a little mention.
Right.
Do we need to recap on anything during the week? Has anything happened to anybody that is worthy of reporting at this particular stage? Winter came.
It got cold.
Yeah, it did. I was parked down by the beach and I was told to leave town after Anzac Day by my brother because it gets cold, and it certainly did. There's that.
That'll teach you to stay in Melbourne.
Yeah, I'm stuck here with a job again. Okay, nothing to report. Let's discuss what we're going to talk about this week.
But I am very pleased that, Katie, you might start to become a regular.
Well, less occasional at the very least.
Less occasional. The less occasional, Katie. I like it.
Yeah, that's good. It's evolving, which is very nice. Mm. This week we're speaking about the most complicated thing in economics, certainly for my mind, which is bonds.
B-O-N-D-S.
Bonds, but we're going to make bonds simple. We're going to simplify bonds. This has been a long journey for me. I have struggled with bonds my entire economic understanding. I didn't even know what bonds were when we first started.
No, not at all.
Yeah, I just went bonds. So we're going to discuss bonds this week. And I'm apparently directing the conversation, which is always a bit dangerous.
Well, when you said bonds, all I could do was groan. So you...
And then we drag Katie in because we needed.
You're going to become like our resident expert, I'm afraid to say.
Well, I mean, my only personal experience with bonds is that it's the word written on my socks, but...
That's true.
Okay, so if we're going to talk about bonds, we've got to go back to basics on a couple of things here. So what I realised when I was researching bonds is that what's incredibly important is an understanding of the origins of money. As we've explained in some previous shows, money is a creation of government. So the government creates money through its central bank, the Reserve Bank of Australia, and it spends it into the economy. So it creates money by paying for things that it wants in the economy. And the army is a good example to use. I mean, it's a terrible example to use, but it's also a good example to use because most economies, sovereign economies that have their own currency also have their own army or law enforcement or something as an early kind of infrastructure thing that they put in place. So, you know, our government will create money when it pays for soldiers. So the money moves from the government side of the ledger, the government sector, and as soon as a soldier is paid, there is money which is now on the non-government side of the ledger in the soldier's bank account. Mm-hmm. So we can see that there'll be an accounting entry on the government side saying that it's created $100, and there'll be a balance on a soldier's account that will say that he's received $100. And that's how 100 new dollars were created. Mm. I should probably pay soldiers more than 100 bucks, so it's probably more than that. So there we have money going into the economy. We went through this through previous episodes. We even had Bill Mitchell explaining some of this to us in previous episodes. So if you want a refresher on currency creation, you can just go back a few shows. We started this beginning of the year. We then talked about tax in previous in following episodes, and that's where the soldier might have had to pay $30 in tax. And so that $30 then went from the non-government side of the economy, that we'll call that the ledger of the non-government side, and it went back to the government side. And the government records that it's received $30 in tax, and that $30 is then removed from the economy that people can use. It's moved from the private sector economy. And so it's effectively extinguished. The private sector economy has lost $30 that it had before. Now the private sector economy only has $70 to deal with rather than the $100 it started off with. So when the government receives money, it's taken out of circulation. And when the government spends money, it's bringing new dollars into circulation. Mm-hmm. Pretty basic. We're with us so far. Is this making sense?
I think I'm with you. Mm-hmm. Are you with him on that?
Yep. I'm on board.
Okay.
So there we have a government spending $100. It's received $30 in tax. There's $70 left. Now, the orthodox view is that every dollar, this is not our view, right? Because the orthodox view has a different understanding of the origins of money. And this is why it's a very kind of an important thing. The orthodox view says that all government spending needs to be funded by its citizens. And that if it spends $100, it needs to collect $100 in tax from the non-government side of the economy, which is us, the private citizens, and that will fund their operations, which from our point of view, from an MMT point of view, is insane, because the government made that $100, and if you taxed $100 back to pay for that, essentially you've removed all the money from the non-government side of the economy, which means they've got no money just to balance their books. But that's because the non-government, the orthodox view, thinks that money comes from the private sector, not from the government.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they kind of do and they kind of don't. They kind of understand it, but they won't rationalise it. We'll get to that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when we have this $70 left in the economy, the orthodox view is that that's money that the government needs to fund its operations. It's called a deficit. And when they can't collect the money in tax, they issue bonds to the...
Oh, there's that word, bonds.
They issue bonds to the equivalent of the deficit, and they say that that will fund the government operation, because then they'll have received $30 in tax, and they'll have received $70 in bonds. So that bond money goes from the non-government side of the economy over to the government side, which means it's taken out of circulation. And in the orthodox view, the government's got its $100, and the operation is fully funded.
So what this whole next hour is going to be is us arguing with the orthodox view about what the bonds are really doing.
Yeah. For instance, you can see straight away in that simple example, if all that money that the government spent into the economy was then returned to the government, there'd be no money left in the economy. The only way that deficits can be matched by bonds is because that there were previous deficits that have been left in the economy from previous. Government spending. I was about to say budgets, but Bill doesn't like that word. So the government had spent into the economy for many decades before, leaving all this money in the economy. So they can issue bonds, but that these days, at the same time as they're issuing new bonds, there are old bonds being redeemed, and that money's being released back into the economy. Mm. So there's this constant cycle of money coming in and coming out. But the important thing to remember is that when money travels from the non-government side of the economy to the government side of the economy, from the we call that the non-government sector, which is in our kind of experience as the private sector, and it also involves the overseas sector, but let's not get too confused. Mm. When any of that money goes back to the government side of the ledger, it's no longer available in circulation for people to use to buy things. It's been removed from the economy. So that's kind of like an important thing to get your head around. And the other thing is that we constantly hear that bonds are there to fund government spending. Yet if the government created the money before it received the bond, that just doesn't make sense. It's irrational.
But, Katie, do you want to have a go at saying what the orthodox, who we disagree with, and the orthodox is just the mainstream, right? It's what the journalists and the politicians and...
Well, we're talking about Treasury. We're talking about the Australian government.
People running the country.
People running the country on this irrational basis, but yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about the textbooks and all of that. The standard MMT explanation of what bonds are is it's just instead of holding money in a bank account, you're earning practically no interest. You're holding your wealth in the form of a bond, which pays a teeny bit more interest. And if you can do that, why wouldn't you?
So that's the MMT view. And what do these crazy orthodox people think?
Well, I mean, they think that bonds are a revenue raising exercise, which gives them the government sector additional spending capacity, which is nonsense because the bonds themselves are a financial asset. So they've taken the cash or the bank deposits, which are a government issued financial asset, and replaced it with another government issued financial asset to the same value, which also pays interest. So how on earth this can be giving the government additional spending capacity is like mysterious.
Well, it's a cognitive disconnect, really, isn't it? This is the issue here, is that I said at the beginning that we need to understand where money comes from and that the government creates money, but we often hear that the private sector creates money. Well, that's just not true. The government, the private sector uses money and it accumulates money and it can redistribute money, but it doesn't create the money. It's a currency user, not a currency creator. So it's kind of...
So what we're saying is that when the government issues, and we're talking federal government, when they issue bonds, and it's usually through the Treasury, so sometimes people call them Treasury bonds or Treasury securities, when they do that, it is not the government borrowing, and everyone else is going to tell you it is the government borrowing.
Let's go with it, though. Let's be the orthodox view, and, and we're saying that that we have to match all government spending with money collected from the non-government sector, from the private sector. We've received 30 in tax. And we and there's been bonds issued for 70. So those $70 in bonds then transfer from the non-government sector back to the government sector, and we have the $100 that's been spent is fully accounted for. However, with taxation, when you pay your $30 tax, that money moves to the other side of the ledger. There'll be a record of it. It's only a ledger. And there is no expectation that you're ever going to see that money again. If you pay tax, it's money that has gone from the non-government sector to the government sector. It's essentially been removed from circulation. We could almost say it's extinguished, except there is a record of it. And so what they're saying is that bonds achieve the same purpose. However, bonds have a set period of time. They have a maturity date. You might have a one-year bond, a three-year bond, a 10-year bond, I don't know. And what happens is that when the bond is redeemed, it then travels back from the government sector and back into the economy. So taxation stays on the government side, government sector. It's no longer available for use. It's removed from circulation, whereas bonds are only temporarily removed, and then they go back again. So now how that could be said to balance the books, to me, has never made any sense. And it's not up to me to explain orthodox irrationality. Yeah. It's up to them to explain that, right. But that's what they reckon. And not only that, bonds attract interest. And so not only does it... does it go back into the non-government sector and become part of the money supply, it actually creates more money in there through interest. So if anything, it's achieving the exact opposite of what it's supposed to do, which is balance the books from the orthodox point of view. It's actually created more imbalance. But that's their issue to explain, not ours. We understand where money comes from. We understand it doesn't come from the private sector. But they act like it does, even though they know that it doesn't. Because
that's the thing, isn't it? When you said before that you didn't even know what a bond was, I didn't know there was this whole argument about what the bonds are doing. So I'm wondering, should we get into why it's a terrible thing to kind of be issuing these bonds anyway?
It's a terrible thing to be issuing them without a reason, just as part of regular business.
Right.
I mean, traditionally, bonds were used not to fund finance spending, but to temporarily slow the amount of consumption in the private sector. Generally, say during a war, when you want to make tanks and aeroplanes instead of cars and refrigerators.
So there is a good reason for the federal government to issue bonds.
From time to time, if you're doing it for no good reason, then it's, as Warren Mosler, the founder of MMT, says, it's just basic income for people who already have money.
Why does he say that?
Because it's a stream of interest to people who, by virtue of the fact that they've purchased bonds, have nothing better to do with the money.
So there are other bonds, like there are government bonds and then there are private bonds. And so typically if you're, I don't know too much about private bonds, so I'm just speaking from very basic limited knowledge here, as I do with most things because, you know, I'm not a...
hearsay at this point that there are these other bonds.
But other bonds, like you might have a company that wants to raise funds for its operation and it will issue bonds and it'll say... actually, I think this goes back to the, you know, the 1700s, the 1800s, when the English Navy wanted to go pirating, they said it was off to explore, but it was actually to go out pillaging. They would sell bonds to fund the building of a ship, for instance. And if the ship was successful when it went off pirating, if it came back with a load of booty, you'd make some money. But if the ship was cannoned and sank to the bottom of the sea, you lost your money. So with bonds that are issued in the private market, there was risk. You would you could make a lot of money, or you could lose your dough. It just depend on how the operation went. With government bonds, the government bonds are issued by the issuer of the currency. So this is the same mob that makes the money is issuing the bonds. There's no risk that they can't meet the obligations of their bonds when they're redeemed.
Right.
You know, if they're running incredible deficits, spending a lot, that doesn't stop them from redeeming the bond and paying the interest because they're never short because they're the currency creator. So a bond is 100% risk-free.
As long as the government's going to continue to exist, they can always pay back the principal and the yield on the bond.
Yeah, and I think this is where Warren Mosler had his... had his early revelations. Well, I think he made a bit of money on this years ago with the Italian lira, I think it was, before the euro. He understood that a government that issued its own currency could always honour its bond obligations and its interest payments. And there was all this talk about the Italian government, you know, about to fail and in economic trouble and their bonds were very risky. And he's going, well, they can't be risky because the Italian government is still issuing Italian currency and it can always pay. As a consequence, the interest rate on Italian bonds went up because it was seen as a high-risk venture. But if it's a sovereign currency that's issuing the bond and issues the currency, it's a zero-risk investment. And so I think that's how we got into...
So that's why it's basic income for rich people, because they're taking very little risk to earn a little bit of interest.
So we're talking about what are the use of bonds. Well, as Katie said, you can use bonds to... delay the entry of money into your economy, like during World War II, as you were saying, you've got everybody being paid, soldiers being paid, full employment, anybody who has two arms, two legs, even one arm and two legs, or even one leg and two arms, whatever. If you could do anything, you were employed, everybody's getting paid, there's money flowing into the economy during World War II, hand over fist, and there's a shortage of supply. This is a recipe for inflation. So you've got constrained supply and enormous demand because everybody's cashed up. So one way of addressing that was to relieve people of their funds by offering them a good return, dressing it up as a patriotic thing to do. You take some money out of the economy temporarily, and you say if everybody starts spending now, they're not going to have anything to spend it on. It's just going to disrupt the prices of everything. We'll give them 5-year bonds, whatever, and hopefully the war will be finished by then, and then the money can start coming back into
and
the economy.
And they want to do that because they're earning a bit of interest. That's the incentive.
Yeah. But they dressed it up as if it was paying
patriotic.
For the war, patriotic and paying for the war fund. But it wasn't. It was to spread the accumulation of money during dicey times
you were not paying for tanks and aeroplanes, you were being paid for the privilege of not buying anything else in the meantime.
So even back then it was not funding government spending.
No,
and we need to keep repeating this. dear listeners, you're out there. A lot of you have a lot of expertise. If anybody can show us an example of where a bond has ever assisted the government in spending where it couldn't do that through issuing its own currency, we'd love to hear from you. But I don't think there's a single example of it. So, but I'll throw that challenge out there. You know, if the thing is, like, if I love being proven wrong because it means I'm learning something. You know, so
So the other reason, now we were talking earlier before the show, Katie, about the other reason why this idea that the Australian federal government is issuing these bonds under the full funding rule, even though it doesn't have to, but we're in this neoliberal era, so it does. So what would be another drawback or negative or downside of the government doing this when it doesn't have to?
Gives the private sector a whole bunch of collateral that they can use to do borrowing and investment, which sounds like it might be a good thing. But what happened after the war, when the private sector found itself flooded with a whole lot of bonds and still with not much in the way of spending opportunities, is that the financial sector went from just plain ordinary Main Street banks to a wider proliferation of non-bank financial institutions which could use bonds as a funding mechanism, as collateral in loans. So they could issue loans by giving the borrowers money which the institutions themselves had borrowed, but at a cheaper rate than they were lending at.
You said non-bank sector. What's a non-bank?
So that would be things like investment banks, mutual funds of various kinds. These were institutions that nominally worked the way that the mainstream thinks that banks work, by taking money from wealthy people and lending it out to worthy investments.
Right.
But having this storehouse of bonds as loan collateral means that instead of getting their money from people who had loose cash on hand,
yeah,
and looking for a place to do something profitable with it, they found the source of cash in doing their own lending. So so lending begets lending begets lending.
So they're creating all this credit when they don't really have the dollars behind it.
Well, they don't need to have the dollars behind it because my introduction to the world of finance was in my very first job. I worked in a mailroom, and towards the end of the day, we were sent up to the Treasury Department because working for a large multinational corporation, they're done spending for the day. And the last thing they want to do is leave the funds overnight in a bank where it's going to earn very little interest. They want to go off and buy some other, financial instrument that's going to earn them more interest. So the end of the day is a mad scramble to not lose money by leaving it in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened after the war, and especially after financial deregulation in the 80s, was that mad scramble got sort of amplified to this extraordinary degree where, the financial sector really doesn't hold any cash in their kitty anymore, because mm-hmm. they know that when they want to lend, they can just borrow the funds that they lend out.
Mm.
So one thing which I've sort of been wondering about is that, and this ties into that, is that if all the money that the government introduces into the economy is done through deficits, and all of those deficits are matched with bonds, it means that all of the money that enters the economy is then turned into a financial product, as opposed to is that necessarily in the public good? It all has to be rinsed through bonds, which are issued to investment companies, and this is how government-created money enters the economy. It's financialized. It's turned into some sort of financial instrument. The primary purpose for that, we would say, is that it should be for the public good, that the government should be building roads, building hospitals, building schools, doing good things for their community.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that that money enters the economy is through bonds, which are bought by investment companies who then take risks and are doing all this, you know, financial stuff. And it's all very capitalist. It's not necessarily for the public good. It's to make money. It's driven by profit. And that's the entry point of Australian dollars into the economy. I don't think that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's not. I think the creation of money has to happen by running the gauntlet of these of the private sector in a way.
Yeah, it's sort of like before anybody else gets it, we're going to give it to all these capitalist mobs who are trying to make a profit from it, and there's the foundation for your economy. Well,
it's like, they're talking about, we'll probably talk about this later, they're talking about the NDIS costing the government too much money. So it's like every time someone who's qualifies to receive the NDIS get a few dollars from the government, those few dollars also got washed through this process of creating bonds so that some rich person can get some interest.
And it sets up this mindset that money must create profit that's what it's for, when money's not there to make profit. The profit, as we've discussed on this show many, many times, profit just screws everything up. Mm. You know, if you can't do anything unless it's profitable. The NDIS isn't profitable, so we need to throw 160,000 people off the scheme. Yeah. Who says that's a good idea? I mean, this is government money, and they're saying, oh, no, it needs to meet these financial targets. Well, that's baked into the system because money enters it's just the way we think, you know. Well, it's not the way we think. It's the way the orthodox understanding of money is, that there's a money is an instrument to make more money, and the aim of money is to become as profitable as you can, to make yourself as comfortable as you can, to shield yourself from the risks that involved that exist in the economy because of your profit-making ventures, creating scarcity and putting people at risk. It's a feedback, you know.
I think what we're trying to do is have every time you hear them say taxpayer money is paying for something, instead think to yourself, public money is paying for something. And then now what we're seeing is like the private sector or the capitalists, they've hijacked the process almost of creating money. I don't know if you would go that far.
I mean, without a...
You said that so confidently, can you go further?
Imagine living in a town that has six pawnbrokers in it, which is not uncommon these days. Mm. You take your watch to the closest pawnbroker to you, he gives you a bit of money. In return, you'll come back on payday and give him a bit more money to get the watch back. But it doesn't end there. He goes over to the next pawnbroker, gives him the watch in return for a little bit of money and paying back some more later. So he's got some money which he can then lend out to other people. Mm. Then the second pawnbroker goes to the third pawnbroker, and eventually, as we get to the end of the chain, all six pawnbrokers, the watch has passed through their hands. Six loans rather than one have been generated by that one watch. The problem is that if one of those pawnbrokers can't redeem the watch,
the whole thing falls over.
The whole thing falls to bits.
Mm. Well, on that note, speaking of money, shall we take a break? And people are going to be appealing for money.
Sure.
And then we'll see what we've got when we come back with Radio MMT on 3CR Community Radio.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
and wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
The benefit cards never occurred to me to blame my family for life being so damn hard. I should have paid attention back when I was in school, then I could figure up the tax. I would know a lot of facts. I missed the class where they taught the rules. I was memorizing capitals. I was in the spelling bee. I must have skipped the part where they taught the art of private equity. I was selling chocolate bars. I had a disorder. I was cutting up a frog, got lost in the fog, learning how to play recorder. If you only worked a little harder. If you worked a little harder. Ah-ah. If you worked a little harder. Ah-ah. If you worked a little harder. You'd have a lot more. So the shame and the blame's on you for being so damn poor. It ain't the banks, and it ain't the taxes. It ain't the payday loans and high rent homes and predatory fees and practices. Wave your dumb flag, whatever it means. But you should ask yourself, when it comes to health of the poor, really all that free if you worked a little harder. Ah, if you worked a little harder. Ah, if you worked a little harder, you'd have a lot more. So the blame and the shame's on you for being so damn poor. Yeah,
It's Your Fault for Being Poor. And that was Poor by Jesse Wells.
Love Jesse Wells. It's almost worth playing twice.
It is, but we won't.
Okay, so now where are we going with Bonds from here? I think it's worth mentioning that Bonds used to serve a purpose, and I don't have a good understanding of this. I just know that people who know far more than I do say that when we had a gold standard or when we had our dollar attached to the US dollar, bonds were used to maintain parity for some. I've had it explained to me a number of times, and I do remember at the time when it's telling me, and it makes lots of sense, and then I walk out of the room and it just evaporates. Do you know anything about this, Katie?
Oh, well, I mean, yeah. In principle, if you have an open promise to supply gold for every dollar that somebody has, whenever they just rock up at the central bank and say, give me my gold, please, you want to minimise people's opportunity to do that. So giving them an interest-bearing asset instead means that you don't have to cover absolutely every dollar you issue with gold in the vault, which is very useful, very sensible.
Because that was the arrangement, wasn't it? You could legally, when there's a gold standard, you could legally rock up to the appropriate department at Treasury and say, here's my $100, give me $100 worth of gold. That was the kind of
that was in principle the deal.
Yeah.
In practice you might have had a bit of difficulty doing it.
But to avoid that, they issued bonds as another way of doing it. And there are a whole other range of reasons for this. Bill Mitchell's explained it to me, Stephen Hale's explained it to me. I sit there and I go, yeah, and I do understand at the time. I go, nod, nod, nod. But it's historic, right? In 1983, when Paul Keating floated the dollar, all of those reasons for holding bonds with a parity with the US dollar and gold standards evaporated. They ceased to be. Mm. So, but the idea was handy for the orthodox to hang on to, and this is because that constrained government spending. It put the reins on what the government could and couldn't do. Now, if you're a neoliberal fascist exploiter, as most people who control this economy are, they like it when the government has the reins on it, and so they use bonds and government debt to constrain government spending. You know, this is why they keep on saying, "Oh, the government's in debt. We can't afford to do this. We can't afford to do that. We'll do it for you instead."
Because if the government spent, they might spend it on services for people, and then people wouldn't be so desperate they would take any job that these capitalists will offer them at exploitative wages and terrible conditions.
Yeah, you know, and anything that the government has done, well, the private sector can do better. So about we just privatise everything and chuck it over our way? So it's in the neoliberal profit-driven model's favour to maintain this myth of government debt. We should talk about what government debt actually is. Okay, so if we go back to the beginning of this show, what we're saying is that all government spending needs to be matched with dollars that are returned to the government from the non-government sector. The government spends $100; it needs to collect $100. That's what they say. That's not what we say. We say that's insane, right? Let's be perfectly clear about that. So effectively, what they're saying, and we understand that the government creates all the currency. So what they're effectively asking for is a tax rate of 100%.
Yeah.
So, and by their true unadulterated vision of returning all money to the government that's been spent by the government, that means they would have to collect all the money in the economy and send it back to the government, and the books would be squared, right? Now,
what would that do? Well, that would leave no money in the economy.
Do you know, we'd turn into a post-communist society. We would then enter anarchy with a post-monetary society. So what these capitalists...
That's the shortcut.
..are actually suggesting is that we turn to communism, which I'm all in favour of. I think
that would be fully automated luxury communism or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Without the luxury, yeah.
Anyway, if we take a more current version of what government debt is, government debt is equal to the amount of bonds on hand. And so if you think about
that's
bonds...
That's the definition of the government debt.
Yeah. Well, an example of this was the Howard and Costello years from the late 90s and the early 2000s, where they eliminated government debt. What they meant by that was that they had redeemed all of the bonds on hand.
Well, they came close. They came jolly close.
Yeah, I thought they did, and they had to pass special legislation because all of these institutions that require need bonds for their existence, all of these investment opportunities, needed bonds in their portfolio mix, and because they didn't have it, they had to get special legislation passed so that the government could issue bonds even though there was no deficits and they had no need to.
So it was a case of metaphorical pawnbrokers having nothing left to pawn.
Yeah.
The supply of private credit, which we all depend on, just dried up, which around 2002-03, the amount of government securities in circulation went from about 20% of GDP down to less than 5%.
Less than 5%, yeah. And I know that they declared that they there was a date, I think it was around 2005, 2006, they said they'd eliminated the government debt that had been all paid back. Well, that's all good and well, but what happens with a bond is redeemed, and as soon as it's redeemed, it then enters back into circulation on the non-government side of the ledger, the economy, which is the stuff we use. So all of the bonds that have been redeemed prior to the bonds that were currently on issue, they're ignored. They're taken away from that equation. Apparently that money is allowed to stay in the economy. It's not part of government debt, even though it was paid into the economy by the government. They say so. Their method was wrong anyway. So even by their own methodology, the idea of government debt is wrong. It doesn't make any sense. And look, any time any of you orthodox economists want to explain to us your origin story of money, I'd love to hear it because, again, if we're wrong, we'll learn something. But, you know, we've been over this a few times. So this idea of government debt, it serves a profit-driven neoliberal agenda to constrain government from spending, to make it sound like they're in debt, so that they can take over the operations and run the economy.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, I mean, at this point around the turn of the century, it's in the budget papers from that year, the government had a decision to make whether or not to actually pay off the debt, which means killing the secondary market in government securities, which effectively means killing off the non-bank financial sector because they've got nothing to use as collateral for raising their own funds, which they then go and lend out. It was a choice between achieving the long-held dream of eliminating the debt at the expense of killing the private financial system, which had expanded massively since deregulation in the 80s and was very, very profitable.
And I just love the irony that the methods that they're taking to abide by their profit-driven agenda then undermine the whole model of their profit-driven agenda, because by removing bonds, they remove the crucial instrument that these financial institutions need to take other risks when they've got this risk-free management in their portfolio. So
the government was forced to conclude that all this nasty government debt was actually good after all.
Not just good, essential, you know. Yeah. So they find another way around it, you know.
Essential for a bloated, parasitic financial sector.
Yeah, yeah.
Indeed.
Whoever creates the money has the power. So long as this myth is continued that the money comes from wealthy enterprises, from the private sector, that they create money, you know, and we hear this all the time, we need private enterprise to make the money that we need in the economy. That's where the power lies. People will always chase the money. They'll go, right, this is where the decisions are made. So if there's a perception that the private sector is making money and driving the economy, they then get to influence policy decisions. And that's why we hear that we need business to succeed. We need to have good, strong, profitable entrepreneurs who are making money for the rest of the economy. That misperception, that mythology is created by making sure that people don't understand that the government creates money. If they understood that the government creates money, then all the policy decisions, all the power bases, all that political power would shift back to the government, which is where it should be.
But what I'm learning from what even Katie's saying now is that I'm really seeing how that capitalist class is writing itself into the processes, isn't it, of government currency creation and managing the economy.
Yeah.
I mean, they must have been able to sort of, back then during the Costello surpluses, they must have been able to make the argument, oh, we're actually essential to the economy, so you need to keep us going.
Yes, indeed, and which makes those institutions essentially agents of government. Mm. It is public policy to make the rich richer.
It's working quite well too. I always get a bit depressed when I think about this. We've talked about what would you do if you came by a massive amount of money. You know, let's hear about these big TAS Lotto wins or something. So let's say you win $100 million, right, and you want to promote our cause. What would you do? The spending that is done by the conservatives, the people in power, just dwarfs anything that I can think of. They've got all these institutes set up. They've got like the Cato Institute. They've got the Heritage Foundation. Yes. All of these. What are the ones in the
all the Atlas Network.
The people. Atlas Network. Yep. The IPA. All these mobs. You know, Tim Wilson was in that mob. He's my local member down where we just got back in again. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got all the finances and the resources to create these bogus institutions that support their mythology, and it's when it's done with such consistency and with such backing, it's very persuasive.
Yeah.
The problem is
it's hard to turn this sort of stuff into a campaign issue, isn't it? To say, for example, I often hear the MMT economists say that we really should not be issuing bonds when we're spending. Would that be right?
Yep. In fact, the idea is, without any sensible reason to do otherwise, there's no reason for the government to be paying any interest on anything.
Mm.
What happens if we let's just go through the exercise? What happens if we remove bonds? Let's say no more bonds. We're just not going to do it. What would be the repercussions of that?
Well, I mean, decision-making about where spending gets allocated would fall back into the hands of the democratically accountable government rather than in the hands of institutions are accountable to their shareholders or owners in the case of private companies.
I sort of think about, like, this is my own personal selfish thoughts on what happens to bonds. Is I'm approaching the retirement age. I'm going to be accessing my superannuation in the next few years. And I know that that superannuation fund probably has a fair percentage of bonds in their portfolio. What happens to my superannuation fund?
Well, that's a question of how do we get there from here when it comes to eliminating the private financial sector is how do we do it without harming the interests of people who are dependent on these private funds for their for their retirement security.
Yeah, I was reading something on this afternoon that the superannuation funds were set up to to enable people to have a comfortable retirement, but they've now turned into this beast which needs to be fed by workers. So it's kind of flipped. It's rather than the superannuation companies serving their customers. Their customers need to serve the superannuation funds, which now have trillions of dollars and carry high risk. They've now got to start offshoring the money because there's nowhere left to invest it in Australia. Mm. So it's turned into this beast which needs to be fed the whole time. And what occurs to me is, and then you've got disruptions in the world like Putin and Trump and all this sort of stuff going on. So my superannuation, my future is now dependent on maniacs in the world and what they do with oil and the rest of it. And this goes back to previous conversations we've had about, Keating privatising the retirement of people onto themselves. If these funds are going to collapse or they're going to have to be honest and take their own risks without relying on government bonds as this 100% guaranteed part of their portfolio mix, it means that governments would need to be more responsible for the welfare of their population rather than outsourcing it to these financial institutions. I'd be happier with that.
I mean, from our point of view, I think it's very hard to argue that what we have at the moment is more efficient than just giving pensioners the money they need when they need it.
Yeah, and proper money, not some sort of bare subsistence existence, we're perfectly capable of doing it. Obviously the money's there, it's entered the economy, it's just all gone into superannuation funds. So why couldn't the government just handle that directly? Why do we need a financial institution to be some sort of intermediary to people's kind of retirement security? That just seems like everything else. And this goes back to the previous conversation. When all the money in the economy enters through these financial institutions, we all become players in a big financial investment economy when it doesn't need to be that way. But we just take it for granted because that's how money is operated these days. It's bizarre.
So if we weren't selling bonds and if we weren't selling federal government treasury bonds at all, then there would have to be some kind of a transition that would be like a safety net to collect or to save the people like who do have the average household that does have investments or whatever.
Because not all of these financial institutions are evil. Some are, I'm sure.
But it's the way money has pooled. And when it pools in big ways, then you end up with power blocks, right? You end up with people able to lobby the federal government to get laws written in their favour to create things like, yes, we must have full funding.
It's kind of interesting with the unions being involved with superannuation. I know that the Conservative parties didn't like that because now all of a sudden you've got these so-called left-wing organisations which are in charge of large amounts of money, the industry super funds. That's not something that the conservative orthodoxy was at all comfortable with. But I wonder whether that's been corrupted.
I think it's certainly resulted in a sort of union system where the purpose of being in a union is the superannuation fund, and maybe if you're lucky, a wine of the month club, and unions don't see it as their business anymore to represent workers.
Yeah, it's all like I say, everything becomes financialized as opposed to looking after the public good.
Look, I'm sure that there are. We know that there are some good union people out there. We meet with them, and their hearts are in the right places. But they're now controlled by a system which has been financialized, which is profit driven, and for them to do the best for their members, they have to enter into all of these schemes and these investment kind of organizations, as opposed to being able to deal with these things more directly, which is just the same. It's the same with everything. Everything gets turned into, well, we'd like to help you, but we've got to make sure that this venture is profitable, and therefore we need to have a mix in our portfolio which involves this, and that needs to be that, and there you are, you're stuck in it. It's
So to sum up, Kevin,
yes,
why do people need to know about bonds?
Well, they don't really. This is the thing. It's kind of like bonds serve no purpose. All that the listener needs to take away from this discussion is that bonds do nothing to fund government spending. That is a complete myth. And I repeat, if somebody can show me one example where one bond has stopped a currency issuing government from issuing currency to meet that demand, let me know. But it doesn't exist. So, but bonds serve these other purposes. And as we become more and more capitalist, they become more and more intertwined in this whole profit-driven way that we run our economy, as opposed to that money being used directly for the public good. It's all going to be rinsed through some profit-making venture before they're happy to release it into the public, where it should be.
So when we've got these financialized institutions running the economy, one thing I think of is maybe if they didn't have so much money, we wouldn't see all these big server farms being built, and instead we might be seeing some more public housing.
A subject for another show, I think.
Yeah, I mean, let's take the example of, say, a superannuation fund gets involved in building public housing, which is could be a way that a Labor orientated government might approach such a project. They might say, look, we can't have government spending going directly into this anymore because we're now captured by neoliberal, and sometimes I think captured by neoliberalism with a little bit too much enthusiasm, especially these days. Be interesting to see what happens to the budget coming up, which we're talking about next week a bit. Yeah, you might see a Labor government saying, rightio, well, we're going to get the superannuation funds involved in funding the building of public housing, but they'll probably call it social housing.
Community housing.
Put a bit of a mix in it and throw a few profit incentives in there, and the whole thing will get diluted, like it always does. Whereas it'd just be better if the government just built public housing like they used to,
Build public housing, just pay retirees enough money to live on.
Yeah. I mean, what would happen if you paid the age pension isn't a retirement pension, it's an age pension, which I was listening to a seminar the other day because I've been investigating this. So it's just saying if you've reached this age, it's not contingent on this, but you've been in society long enough, we're going to give you a hand looking after you because you're getting old. And I am getting old, Anne. My back hurts. I'm a handyman. Stop pretending that I don't hurt. I fix things. I bend over. I'm in my 60s and I'm still fixing things and lifting things, and it's harder, right? Yes. And so I could use a bit of assistance.
A bit of a helping hand.
Yeah,
yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't need to be relying on some investment scheme that's going to turn a profit for me to do that. It's just like we can do this as a community. So you give people in there who are a bit aged to earn money. They spend it. The economy's better off. Good.
Done. Katie, it's been lovely seeing you. Kevin, lovely seeing you in person.
You're kicking us off.
Yeah, I'm getting rid of us because Mafalda is coming right up.
Mafalda's coming up. Now, Radiothon is also coming up, so don't forget that. And we'll talk about the budget probably next time.
I tell you another thing that's coming up. Sunday morning, our dear friend and colleague Jesse and I will be appearing on the Local Food Connections program to talk about supermarkets.
You're working on 3CR.
You're working on other shows, Katie.
I'm
I can't believe it.
Okay. I'm
making friends.
You guys got to be diplomatic. Branching out. Jeez.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, yeah, no, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomics band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalence, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
We're going to do the regression theory of money to music.
That'll work. That's good. Regression theory of money. What rhymes with regression? Regression, depression, instability. There's a world of other things.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.